This is Rank and File Radio on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Carruthers Hall, Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. Rank and File Radio is a weekly program covering labor issues from national and international perspectives. We are your hosts, Doug Nesbitt
and Andrew Stevens. On this week's show, we interview Professor John Thompson, author of No Debate, The Israel Lobby and Free Speech at Canadian Universities.
But first, here's this week's labor news update.
On January 26, demonstrators rallied inside the state capitol building in Madison, Wisconsin, to protest Governor Scott Walker's State of the State address. The Scott Walker recall campaign has collected more than 1 million signatures. Here's what the Capitol building sounded like outside the governor's address.
Operations at Vale's five mines in the Sudbury area were suspended indefinitely in the wake of a miner's death on January 29th. 47-year-old Stephen Perry, a 16-year veteran of the mine, was killed by a collapsing rock face. Rick Bertrand of Steelworkers Local 6500, representing the miners, has called the death unacceptable. Speaking to the CBC, Bertrand expressed anger, noting that four miners have died in Vale-owned Canadian mines in the past 12 months, including three miners in Sudbury and one in Thompson, Manitoba. These deaths have all occurred since the end of a one-year strike by USW 6500 against Vale's aggressive demands for concessions.
In Halifax, public transit workers represented by the Amalgamated Transit Union Local 508 are still in bargaining with the Halifax Regional Municipality. The workers are in a legal strike position as of February 2nd. The five-month York Region transit strike has also come to a close as members of ATU 1587 voted 80% in favor of ratifying a new five-year contract. After a 94% strike mandate, Hamilton transit workers of ATU 107 reached a tentative deal with the city on January 28th, 2 days before a strike deadline.
The lockout of 500 workers at the electromotive diesel plant in London, Ontario, has entered its second month. In the wake of the 10,000-strong labor demonstration on January 21st, Caterpillar announced record profits of $4.9 billion and revenues of $32 billion in 2011. The visible greed and anti-worker decisions of Caterpillar has led to a handful of retail stores in southwestern Ontario, including regional farm equipment store TSC, to pull Caterpillar products from their shelves. Workers, mainly from the Canadian Auto Workers Union, have also stepped up pressure on Caterpillar executives and Tory politicians. On January 25th, two Tory MPs from London were confronted by locked-out workers. All the MPs could offer was hollow words of consolation and claimed that the dispute was not a matter of federal jurisdiction. Also on January 25th, members of CAW Local 88 from the Kami Assembly Plant in Ingersoll, blockaded a locomotive that had been built and shipped out of EMD London shortly before the lockout started. A dozen cities and seven provinces also witnessed pickets at Caterpillar dealerships on January 26. Similar pickets organized by labor activists were carried out in Ottawa the following day.
A general strike in Belgium on January 30th paralyzed the city of Brussels. The main railway station and the international airport were shut down for the day. Government offices and schools were closed as well. Labor unions organized the strike to protest austerity measures being implemented by the government and a lack of progress in public employee negotiations. The strike was timed to coincide with a meeting of European leaders.
For the first time in years, union membership in the United States and Great Britain has risen. Observers link the slight rise, instead of a decline, to labor's campaigns to fight government cutbacks and anti-union legislation. In the U.S., the number of unionized workers increased by about 50,000 to nearly 15 million in 2011. In the U.K., a number of unions are reporting a rise in membership after a massive strike in November aimed at protecting pensions. The GMB union, for example, recorded a membership surge with 20,000 workers joining the mainly private sector union in November and October of last year. The public employee union in the UK, Unison, also reported a rise in membership after the pension strike in November, when almost 2 million workers walked off their jobs.
The Congress of South African Trade Unions is tackling corruption in South Africa head-on. It has created an anti-corruption unit which will investigate corruption in the government. The union will initiate legal proceedings when it finds corrupt activity.
15,000 people in the Russian city of Yekaterinburg rallied in support of Vladimir Putin for the president. The rally was won in a series being organized by the Russian Trade Union Federation, the largest labor federation in the country. On Saturday, February 4th, the Confederation of Labor of Russia will hold an anti-Putin demonstration.
According to the International Labor Organization, or the ILO, there were 75 million young people unemployed in the world in 2011. Young people, those between 15 and 24, are three times more likely to be unemployed than adults. Youth employment was one of the topics raised by labor leaders at the conference of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland last week.
That was this week's Labor News Update. You're listening to Rank and File Radio on CFRC 101.9 FM. Stay tuned to our interview with John Thompson after these messages.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Rank and File Radio, a program about work, the labor movement, and sticking it to the man.
Tune in Wednesday evenings, 5:30 to 6 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Whoever said the number 13 is unlucky? At Reload 13, Kingston's Queer Film and Video Festival, we are showing 88 films and 28 epic programs and 5 parties that are sure to make your camp experience that much luckier. So if you've never been to camp, here's your chance. Join us on January 26th until February 5th at the Screening Room, when the moon comes up and the campers come out. For showtimes, ticket information, and more, visit www.reload.com. See you at camp.
In this segment of the show, I speak with John Thompson, author of No Debate, The Israel Lobby and Free Speech at Canadian Universities. During 2008-2009, organizations like B'nai B'rith, the Jewish Defense League, and the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs made concerted efforts to block a conference on statehood for Israel and Palestine being held at York University. Titled Israel-Palestine, Mapping Models of Statehood and Paths to Peace, the conference took place in June of 2009 with sponsorship from York University, Queen's University, and the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada. Scholars from Canada, the United States, and Israel were involved as panelists and keynote speakers for the event. Controversy began at York soon after the Israel-Palestine conference was advertised. The event was repeatedly denounced, and university administrators, like York University President Mamdou Choukri, received countless emails and phone calls about the event. York, as the host university, was warned of boycotts and the cessation of donations. Full-page ads were even published in national newspapers denouncing the university's decision to host the conference. When York and its co-sponsors refused to shut down the conference, special interest groups persuaded the Harper government to intervene by contacting Shirk. In response, Shirk made an unprecedented intervention. The Canadian Association of University Teachers followed by making public issue of the government's interference. Thompson's book is a report of an investigation commissioned by CAUT into the controversy surrounding the conference. The book establishes the facts of the case through countless documents received through Freedom of Information requests, as well as a context for understanding them. Central to the book is the meaning of academic freedom in Canada. The book also looks at the role played by unions, namely faculty unions, in securing and maintaining academic freedom. This is a task that the CAUT has been active in for decades. John Thompson is a professor emeritus in the Department of Mathematics and Statistics at the University of New Brunswick. He is a former chair of the department and a former president of the faculty union at UNB. He chaired the Academic Freedom and Tenure Committee of the Canadian Association of University Teachers in the late 1980s and received the James B. Milner Award for contributions to academic freedom in 1993. In addition to his investigation and report on the threat to academic freedom involving the case at York, Professor Thompson chaired the Independent Committee of Inquiry, commissioned by CUT, into the dispute involving Dr. Nancy Olivieri, the University of Toronto, the Hospital for Sick Children, and Apotex Incorporated. Here's my interview with Professor Thompson. John, tell me about the history behind the book No Debate.
Well, briefly, the history is that there was a conference jointly sponsored by the law schools that were law faculty people at York and Queen's Universities held at York that generated a huge and very public controversy involving a federal minister and Shirk, the agency that had granted a substantial conference grant. I was asked to conduct this inquiry by the Canadian Association of University Teachers, CAUT, and was given a broad mandate to look into questions as to whether or not there had been threats to academic freedom and the academic integrity of the conference program.
Can you explore a bit for me what you define as academic freedom?
Well, the briefest possible explanation is that university professors ought to be able to conduct research and define their teaching efforts in terms of the content and the structural background with a minimal amount of interference from either inside or outside of the university. By minimal interference, I don't mean to say that they have no responsibilities to go along with certain general institutional principles, but rather their views, both in the research and in their public utterances on matters not necessarily connected with their research, is such that they should not be subjected to any kind of restrictions or disciplinary action based on what they think or say or write. So it basically protects them against institutional disciplinary action.
Why did the CAUT select you to write the report, which is now the basis for the book?
Well, I had a number of years of experience generally on dealing with cases of academic freedom, both at my own university, UNB in Fredericton, and across the country some years ago for CAUT as head of their Academic Freedom and Tenure Committee. I had also been involved in two other committees of inquiry of roughly comparable complexity in the previous couple of decades. One was an inquiry into matters that arose in connection with the murders by Valerie Fabricant in the engineering faculty at Concordia in Montreal. The other involved events around the dispute between medical researcher Nancy Olivieri in Toronto and a pharmaceutical manufacturer, Apotex Incorporated. So partly, I guess, it was based on previous experience.
The subtitle of your book is The Israel Lobby and Free Speech at Canadian Universities. I was wondering if you could tell me how you define and understand the Israel Lobby as a term.
Well, it's a very complex, amorphous sort of collective phrase, I guess. And to illustrate the complexity, two American professors, very senior, distinguished people, one at the University of Chicago, John Mearsheimer, and Stephen Walt, who was at the time dean of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, wrote a long article and then a full-length book on the impact of the Israel lobby on American domestic politics and foreign policy, and in particular, its influence on university campuses in the United States. They spent a chapter of roughly 40 pages in length characterizing what they meant by the term Israel lobby, and I use the term in the same general sense, but very briefly they refer to organizations whose objective is to persuade governments, Canadian, American, if I translate it into the Canadian context, to uncritically support policies of the government of Israel. They've also been, these organizations have been active on campus in a great many ways, listed by Mearsheimer and Walt, and there's some parallels here in Canada, in attempting to limit criticism of policies or actions of Israel on university campuses. And this sort of activity manifested itself quite significantly in the controversy over the conference sponsored by York and Queen's faculty members.
In the book, you list a number of organizations that I believe, if this is a fair characterization, fall under that umbrella of the so-called Israel lobby. One was the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs. There was also B'nai B'rith, as well as the Jewish Defense League.
Yes.
And in the book, you lay this out very clearly, that they tried to defame York. They targeted panelists and organizers. Do you think that this assault that these organizations waged against the conference itself, and I think the intent and the politics behind it, do you think that they were successful in damaging the reputation of the scholars as well as the institution, York University?
Ultimately, they weren't. I mean, it wasn't so much the reputation of universities, it was the autonomy of universities to be places of free inquiry that was under attack, although they did, particularly in the case of B'nai B'rith and its public statements, very strongly attack York, especially. So I don't think ultimately they damaged reputations, and the positive part of the story is, as I recounted, the conference went ahead ultimately as planned, with the funding originally secured and the program as designed by the organizers. The real message in part of my report is that what happened here in this Canadian instance is in contrast to what happened in a number of instances in the United States, Britain, and France, where similar sorts of events were actually canceled by as a result of pressure from Israel lobby agencies.
Following the conference, another report was commissioned and written by the Honorable Frank Iacobucci, which is titled, obviously, by his namesake, the Iacobucci Report, The Mapping Conference and Academic Freedom, a report to President Mamdou Choukri. What is your response to that report and its conclusions?
Well, very briefly, I criticized the methodology that the Honorable Mr. Iacobucci used in constructing his report. I criticized the logic of his arguments, and I criticized his finding, both on the basis of methodology and on evidence. I found overall that, among other things, he also invoked a conception of academic freedom which is very different and much more restrictive than the prevailing conception in Canada today, and dates back variously to some American or German models of academic freedom, which were more restrictive and are much older in their origins. So he took, in effect, a reactionary approach to academic freedom.
You mentioned initially that the basis for no debate was commissioned by the CEUT.
Yes.
Can you tell me a bit about the organization and its history as a representative of faculty unions and its stance on the issue of academic freedom as well?
Yes, the CEUT has been around for about 60 years. I think it was founded sometime around 1951 by several professors at Queen's, McGill, Toronto, and several others. I think UNB was an early member as well. In the 50s, university professors in Canada had very few fringe benefits with respect to their unemployment, and their salaries were really very low because institutions in those days, the universities, had very little money. So the main focus for most of the 1950s was on issues connected with salary and benefits. It's only in 1958 that CAUT suddenly became very active as a defender of academic freedom as a result of a dismissal case at what used to be United College in Winnipeg. Now it's University of Winnipeg. Ever since that time, CAUT, in the subsequent half century, has been able to construct a widely accepted conception of academic freedom in Canada that includes the best aspects of the American and British traditions and goes beyond each in terms of the scope of the conception and the protections afforded. And one of the reasons why CAUT has been more effective than its British or American counterparts is because collective bargaining was translated into the university sector much more effectively than in either the UK or the US for various reasons. For example, in the US, there is an enormous variation in state labor codes from one state to another. So it's very hard to have a coherent system of any kind in any field of industrial relations from one state to another, whereas system is much more uniform across Canada. I should say not all faculty associations that belong to CAUT are unionized under provincial labor codes, but even the ones that are not, for instance, the association at the University of Toronto, operate as if they were trade unions, and they are treated with corresponding respect by their university administrations. So that, for instance, at the University of Toronto, while they don't have the right to strike because they're not a union, all significant disputes, whether over individual rights, such as academic freedom cases, or salary disputes, can be ultimately taken before an independent Board of Arbitration and resolved in the same sort of high standard way as other industrial disputes. So that's one of the big differences between Canada and its Western counterparts.
In the book, you mention York University Faculty Association and the leading role it, along with the CAUT, played in making academic freedom really a labor relations and an employment issue. What kind of connections do you think need to be drawn between academic freedom and the issue of work and employment in the university setting?
Well, I mean, the simple answer is that academic freedom is better protected in an environment where there is an effective trade union representing the faculty. That's been the experience in Canada, and if not a trade union, then as at the University of Toronto or universities in Alberta, they have in effect the same kind of protections under a different legal framework. The situation at York is a bit complicated, although the main faculty association at York, UFA, its acronym, is a large member with, that is, they have many members, individuals. It's a large organization within CAUT. It's been unionized since roughly the mid-1970s. The professors in the law faculty never belonged to UFA. They have their own small organization, and so far they have no significant autonomous procedures of their own that would protect people. But so far, the good thing is, ultimately, the administration was willing to apply the same standard, in this case, of academic freedom to people in the law faculty as in the larger faculty body at York. You know, I particularly noted the positive role of President Mamdou Choukri in ensuring that that happened.
In the book, you describe one of the leading elements of the controversy, which was Minister Goodyear's involvement and direct intervention. What kind of threats are you seeing? Are these new threats where you have government intervening in the academic integrity of a funding agency like SHRC?
Yes, it was unprecedented. Never before since the arm's length research granting agencies, there are three of them, one in medicine and health areas, Canadian Institute for Health Research. There is a Science and Engineering Council, NSERC, and then there's the Social Sciences and Humanities Council, the one that funded this conference held at York. The modern legislation creating these agencies as they have operated dates from the 1970s, and what was distinctive in the debates in Parliament and in committees when these agencies were established, both the Liberal government of the day, Trudeau was the Prime Minister, and the opposition, Progressive Conservatives, strongly took the view and said so on the floor of the House that this should be an arm's length agency, with SHRC in particular, and similar with the other two agencies. So what's different with the Harper government is that they have for the first time interfered directly in the operation of one of the granting councils, specifically with respect to the academic content of a research project. That never happened before in Canada in modern times.
Do you think there's a relationship between public funding for universities and the maintenance and protection of academic freedom?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, if you look at the United States, the extent to which academic freedom is protected in a university varies enormously, not just from state to state, as I mentioned, but also from university to university. So in this report that I published, I gave as an example two American tenure cases, one at Columbia and the other at the large Roman Catholic University in Chicago, the name of which escapes me at the moment. In both cases, there were intense attacks on the individuals to try to and on the universities to try to, by supporters of Israel, try to persuade the university to deny tenure to these faculty members. And at Columbia, which has a longer tradition and better procedures for protecting such rights, the university withstood the pressure and granted tenure to this distinguished woman anthropologist. At DePaul University, Chicago is a comparably large institution in Chicago, but doesn't have the same kind of strong traditions that Columbia had. And there, an arguably even more senior and more distinguished professor in terms of the extent of his publication record was denied tenure, although he was recommended by the faculty.
Since the, if you want to call it, the incident at York, stemming from the conference. What do you think some of the leading challenges are for faculty unions, scholars, students, graduate students at Canadian universities?
Well, there is increasing pressure on all of the structures that have evolved in Canada, especially since the 1960s, to protect individual rights and freedoms and institutional autonomy. And those are all under pressure in this generally neoliberal / neoconservative environment that we're now in, headed by a government that's heavily influenced by both neoliberal and neoconservative dogma of the American sort. And I say of the American sort because Germany, since almost immediately after the Second World War, had a neoliberal government regime imposed on it, but they've always respected labor rights in Germany, and they've not significantly attempted to erode those yet. So there are different flavors of neoliberalism. The most pernicious in terms of its adverse influences on democracy are the American variety.
You just finished listening to Rank and File Radio's interview with John Thompson, author of No Debate, The Israel Lobby and Free Speech at Canadian Universities. The book is published by Lorimer in Canada and is available in paperback for $22.95.
That's all the time we have this week. Join Rank and File Radio next week, Wednesday, 5:30 to 6 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Me and Jesus Christ go down to the Tiger Cats Liberty game. They hated Toronto Argonauts from the visitor stands. I always knew that our Lord and Savior was gonna be a Hamilton Tiger Cat fan. And Pinball Clemens says, God, why have you forsaken me? And Jesus says, well, Pinball, you're just coaching the wrong team. And then the Argos lose by a trillion points. And choirs of angels come down and sing Argos sucks. I always knew that Jesus was from Hamilton. I always knew that Jesus was from Hamilton. Me and JC go drinking on a Thursday night. And there's a super cute girl sitting on the Jesus, this is right. And she's been talking to some jabroni in an Orange County chopper shirt all night. And I say, Jesus, is she gonna go home with him? And Jesus says, well, BA not on my watch. And then the locusts, they fly in. And the jabroni, he's got no skin. I always knew that Jesus was from Hamilton. I always knew that Jesus was from Hamilton.
Aces.
Hi, I'm JV on the Big RC, reminding you to join me every Saturday afternoon between noon and 2 for Strictly 70s and 80s, only on Queens Radio, CFRC FM Stereo, 101.9 FM, 90.9 cable, and on the internet, cfrc.ca. Nowhere else.
Lindsay for the veterans parade, 'cause I-
crossing the internationality.